Good afternoon. The House Committee on Transportation and Economic Development will come to order. It's Friday afternoon. Appreciate you sticking around, particularly some of the members, some others not as much. We have two bills to hear this afternoon, and we'll start with a public hearing on House Bill 3155. Representative Juan, if you'd like to join us, and Zach, you can give us a quick summary, please.
House Bill 3155 requires a public notice of hearing before a governing body of a municipality may activate a urban renewal agency.
Thank you very much. Representative Juan, glad you're here. Take it away,
Thank you very much, Co-Chair Reed and Co-Chair Bence. Matthew Wand, representing House District 49. This issue came to my attention over the course of several years very recently, beginning with Chairman of Multnomah County, then-Chair Ted Wheeler, informing the Troutdale City Council that approximately $20 million a year in tax revenue is lost to Multnomah County by virtue of the numerous urban renewal districts within the county. I was shocked by that, in particular because at the time we were looking at a 50-year-old promise for Multnomah County to build a Gresham courthouse. And at that time, the expected cost of the courthouse was $40 million, just two short years of lost revenues to urban renewal. Subsequently, of course, we got our courthouse with much fanfare after 50 years of waiting. But the issue of urban renewal hasn't gone away. More recently, I received a community newsletter by email from Commissioner Kafori asking for public input with regard to a new urban renewal district that's being proposed in the downtown Portland area. I did a little bit of research and realized that that area could be created as an urban renewal district just by vote of the existing agency, and that once it was declared a district, all of the public processes would then start after it was already declared, where they would accept public input regarding a plan and how to redevelop the area and everything else. That was a big surprise to me because urban renewal is a very important and valuable resource. It is the type of process that an entire community can gather around and support to solve a very specific problem of blight. And that spirit of community is important because you have a very immediate input of funds into that blighted area, and then there's a tail for 20 years or so as you repay that debt. And so without that spirit of community throughout the entire region, the entire area that is repaying the debt over two decades, something really significant is lost. You need that buy-in, and you need the substantial input from the community early. Right now, as I said, the processes are there for public involvement, but that's after the decision is made to create the district. Further, there's very little check on whether or not this area that is proposed anywhere actually is blighted. Now, there's a statutory definition, so we know what blight is. But the requirement isn't there to state why the area is blighted until after the plan is already considered for adoption. And, of course, by then a lot of work goes into creating the plan, and there's a lot of inertia and momentum supporting the plan. By then it's too late. I'm simply asking for what I consider to be a very strong good government bill. Get public involvement early at the front end, before you do all the work, before the inertia, before you spend the time. Make sure the community supports the creation of the urban renewal district immediately. Secondly, make sure you are keeping faith with state law that the area that you're proposing for the urban renewal district is actually blighted under the statute. Again, this is not a bill suggesting that urban renewal is bad or wrong. Really, what I'm trying to push here is more public involvement on the front end to make sure that we are keeping faith with the voters and that we are keeping faith with the other jurisdictions that need to be involved as well. I know, and my last point, and thank you for your time here, I know that there will be opposition to this proposal from me. The first is from a work group of folks that were down in Salem 2 years ago that made some significant changes to the urban renewal legislation. And there was an agreement that for two or three terms, everyone would oppose anything that came to Salem to change the urban renewal law. Respectfully, I don't think that that gets us where we want to go. I don't believe that East Multnomah County was adequately represented in that process with respect to the residents. And so you'll hear from the League or from the PDC or from folks that are invested in urban renewal but I'm here asking for the opportunity for people, residents or citizens that are impacted by this to have greater involvement on the front end before the politicos and the interests have the inertia and then we're just simply drowned out. Secondly, you might hear some discussion that urban renewal is a critical economic development tool. Really, when I look through the statute at what urban renewal is all about, it really is talking about blighted areas. And if you want to talk about economic development, we have better options available that are shorter term and achieve the same ends. Enterprise zones are just one example. It's a short-term investment. It's 3 years of a tax abatement. It doesn't go on for 20 or 25 years. And lastly, there might be a concern expressed that this will require an existing urban renewal agency to do something different or hold a public hearing in order to just simply continue to exist. If you look at the section of the statute that this bill proposes to change, it's talking about the initial determination of an urban renewal district and the vesting of authority in an urban renewal agency. That statute is very specific in the timeline, and it doesn't affect what goes on after the urban renewal district is created and after the agency begins to function, which is after that time period you're moving forward. So almost like having a charter created and then moving forward with ordinances. Well, if you come in and require a different process to create a charter, that doesn't mean that you have to roll back the existing charters that are in place. And that certainly wasn't the intention of this bill, to shut down the authority of urban renewal agencies that are already in existence. As a last matter, I just want to point out that the urban renewal law is very valuable and very important, but it requires involvement from the citizens. And that's all I'm here asking for today, is the opportunity for more citizens to have involvement on the front end and for other folks to be able to check that these areas really are blighted and that this isn't just an opportunity to get some additional funding into an area that's already very productive. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Wand. I imagine we might have some questions for you. If not, I have a question or two, but Representative Sheen, you want to go first?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. So there was a work group of legislators that had some deal to not allow any changes to urban renewal?
You'll have to ask some of the folks that speak in opposition to the bill, but that's my understanding, is that there was a deal made in the 2009 session that urban renewal would be off the table for several sessions.
Representative Sheen, I can answer that question to a certain extent, though I agree with Representative Wand, hearing from the other folks will be helpful in that. The committee that had that jurisdiction last session was Sustainability and Economic Development, on which Representative Benson and I both served, and the groups that came together to propose what was, I think, reasonably described as a consensus approach had agreed, I think, and they can correct me too, to stick together to that plan for some period of time. So that's the I think the nature of that comment, and we'll certainly want them to comment on that as well.
And if I may add, I'm looking at a list of the urban renewal districts here in the Portland area, and there's only two that have actually expired and gone back onto the normal processes. About 15% of the total percentage of Portland area is under urban renewal right now, comprising 20.05 square miles and 12,831 acres. And after that agreement in the 2009 session, there's now a drive to add an additional urban renewal district between Portland State University and the Willamette River and 405 on the south, an area that I used to work in as an attorney. There's active buildings there. There's thriving offices. It's far from urban blight.
Sure. Representative Benz?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It appears that the bill proposes two things. The first is the notice and the hearing, and the second is the findings that particularize the nature of the blight.
Yes.
So what is there a definition of blight? How would we know what's being particularized, so to speak? Where do we look to find that? definition of blight?
I actually don't have the bill in front of me, but there is a statutory definition of blight in the urban renewal statute, and it's, you know, it's one of the definitions like an 005, and it, blight is one of those terms that's defined with several subdivisions as well.
Thank you. So the bill really attempts to do the two things. One, have the hearing. Two, have at least a restriction if there isn't that finding of blight. That's the concept.
That's exactly right. And also at a particular time period, because if you look at the section that we're amending, that has to take place before they can start to incur the cost and move forward with an urban renewal plan. Now, adoption of an urban renewal plan that takes place after you've declared the urban renewal district does require a public involvement. No question about it, and you'll hear that from the PDC and the folks from the City of Portland. But what I'm driving at is, look, let's be realistic about the way politics works. By the time you're putting thousands of dollars into creating a plan and shopping it around to get buy-in, if you've already made the decision that there's a district, you're going to do something. And what I'm trying to get at is this area urban blight, or is this an area that we want, our citizens want us to spend time trying to revitalize?
Good question.
Follow up to that.
Go ahead.
Thank you. So I guess I'm trying to get at what is the more important of the two parts of the bill, the notice or the requirement of the finding. Would you be satisfied with one or the other, or do you have to have both? I'm just curious if one stands on its own.
I actually like the way that they mesh well together, frankly, but I mean, that's up to you guys. I think from a functional standpoint, the findings of fact are probably the most critical, because then as you're going through with your public input about the plan, if there's going to be disagreement about the findings that this was a blighted area, then I suppose you can have that discussion at that time as well. But I really like all of that happening on the front end together.
Thank you.
Thank you. So I had two questions. One, both may be very simple to answer. I noticed on line 9, the bill is written, says, declares after public notice and hearing and consideration of public testimony. Is that something that's also defined, or if the bill were to pass, would it be possible to comply with it by having one public hearing? And is public notice, all those sorts of things are defined elsewhere, or how does that work?
You'll have to check with the experts in administrative law, but I believe that those are key terms that are well understood by administrative law attorneys. My thought, as a non-administrative lawyer, would be that yes, one public hearing is probably going to be enough to meet that standard, and frankly, that satisfies the point that I was trying to make in asking for the bill.
Okay. And then the other one is probably of similar nature, and given the fact that we have at least three lawyers in the room, I didn't know that particularize was a word. And is that also well understood?
Not that I'm aware of, but probably I know I've read it before in statutes.
Okay.
Representative Co-Chair Bence here, though, is kind of the chair of the Country Lawyers Caucus. He probably knows the answer to that better than I do.
Nice of you to implicate him.
Exactly. I move to make it a word.
I don't know that we have the ability to do that. We have to get everyone else to vote on that, Representative.
I ain't in the mood.
Very good. It doesn't seem like we have any other questions. Thank you for your time. You're welcome, certainly, to stick around, but we know you're on leave from the Judiciary Committee, so we'll understand if you need to head that direction.
I will be heading to Judiciary, and please take no offense. Thank you.
Understood. Thanks very much. So we have a few people who have signed up to testify and have been asked to call up four people at once, so we'll do that and leave it to you to rearrange the chairs to accommodate the following four people. Barbara Cartmill, Michael Novak, and Hannes and Alec Jensen, please. Up to you, who would like to go first?
Good afternoon, Chairs Benz and Reed, and members of the committee. My name is Barbara Cartmill, and I am the president of AORA. That is the Association of Oregon Redevelopment Agencies. I'm also the deputy director of the Clackamas County Department of Transportation and Development. Today, I am here on behalf of AORA to testify in opposition to House Bill 3155 and to provide information on past urban renewal legislation and how it relates to this bill. It's important that the committee be aware of a unique collaboration among urban renewal stakeholders that occurred during the 2009 session. These stakeholders aren't a body politic. They're very diverse. The Special Districts Association of Oregon, Clackamas Fire District 1, Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue, Oregon Fire Chiefs Association, the Oregon Fire District Directors Association, the Oregon School Board Association, Multnomah County, the Association of Oregon Redevelopment Agencies, the Association of Oregon Counties, the League of Oregon Cities, the City of Portland, Portland Development Commission, and Clackamas County. We work together in support of the value of urban renewal districts, but also in recognition of the need to add property value to the tax rolls in order to provide funding for services provided by those taxing districts. After a year-long process and immersion into the specifics of urban renewal, the result was the passage of a landmark piece of legislation, House Bill 3056. The development and passage of House Bill 3056 was a difficult but satisfying effort that resulted in key limitations on urban renewal district expansion and tax revenue collection. In addition, the collaborative partners made written commitments to cooperate and communicate on future issues relating to urban renewal districts and tax increment financing. In fact, we established an oversight committee just for that purpose. The group further agreed that it was appropriate to allow time for the affected jurisdictions to gain experience with the significant provisions that were initiated with House Bill 3056 before additional changes were made to urban renewal statutes. We all agreed to indicate our opposition to urban renewal legislation proposed before 2017. AORA is here in support of that understanding and respectfully requests that House Bill 3155 not move forward. I want to elaborate a little bit on those remarks. It wasn't so much to just oppose any future legislation as much as try to stay collaborative in what would move forward and how it moves forward due to the significance of any movement in the statutes. The state statutes can sometimes have a ripple effect, the proverbial pebble in the water. And these major changes that we made, we wanted to have the opportunity to see how those were implemented and reacted to. Specifically relating to House Bill 3155, we oppose this bill, we believe, as a state mandate process that is unnecessary to protect the public or other interested parties. The bill would require a public hearing on a non-emergency ordinance to activate the powers of an urban renewal agency. This isn't necessary. The statutes currently require the municipality adopt a non-emergency ordinance allowing the agency to exercise its powers. As part of that ordinance, the bill would require findings that specify the nature of blighted areas in the jurisdiction. Again, current law already requires a declaration that blighted areas exist in the jurisdiction. We are not aware of any issue with the activation of an agency in over 50 years that the urban renewal has been used in Oregon. In practice, the activation of an urban renewal agency is usually accomplished in tandem with the consideration of approval of an urban renewal plan, requiring a separate set of blight determinations and findings unnecessarily duplicates the already required blight determinations and findings that must be made in order to approve an urban renewal plan. It is appropriate to specify blight findings after a particular area has been identified for urban renewal, after the feasibility of urban renewal to cure blight in that area has been determined, and after those decisions have been fully vetted by the Planning Commission, the overlapping taxing districts, in a public hearing. To specify blight findings before those steps have been taken is a waste of scarce resources, unnecessary, and perhaps even misleading. The current statute is well thought out and requires informing the public and inviting public participation when it is necessary to protect the public interest. I thank you for this opportunity to address the committee. I'm happy to take any questions or...
Thanks very much. Let's hear from the rest of the panel, and then we'll take questions.
Co-Chair Reed, Co-Chair Bence, I'm Alec Jensen. I'm the Executive Officer for Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue. We serve about 440,000 people in 9 cities and 3 counties in the west and south Portland Metroplex. Just for context, in fiscal year 09-10, Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue, the words forego, lost $1.7 million to 6 urban renewal plans. So why on earth would Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue be here testifying in opposition to 3155? Representative Wan used the term spirit of community, and that's what came together in the 2009 legislative session. That was not the first session, you'll recall, that we brought forward urban renewal reform. What made a difference in 2009 was the collaboration of the all of the parties that Ms. Cartmill has named here, and we refer to it as the peace treaty. It's certainly not binding. It certainly isn't intended to suggest that there isn't more that could or should be done as it relates to urban renewal. But out of that has come some great success stories. First of all, we have a level of dialogue and professional collaboration between all of those named parties that we did not have before. We frequently dialogue, talk to each other, bounce ideas off each other. Within Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue, there's two, from our perspective, there's two great stories that came as a result of 3056. You may have read about the city of Tualatin's plan amendment to increase its maximum indebtedness by nearly 400% that was withdrawn based upon engaging the overlapping taxing districts and public input. And we have a story unfolding right now in the city of Beaverton that is profoundly collaborative, where the overlapping taxing districts have been engaged and invited to the table at the very beginning. So essentially my request of you today is to honor that non-legally binding collaborative agreement that we came together on in 2009, allow the process a little more time to work, give us the opportunity to address some of these issues as we are today at the local level. And I'd be happy to answer any questions. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, sir.
Ann Hannis with Association of Oregon Counties. I think Alec and Barb did a good job of giving an overview. As you know, this has been a very controversial and contentious issue over the years, one that the counties have been concerned about. We recognize the benefits that urban renewal has brought, but we also have been concerned about the impacts that it has been on our budgets. And so we thought that with the collaboration that occurred last session that brought forth House Bill 3056 and bringing together parties that have not always worked well on this issue to really start looking at how do we collaborate, how do we solve some of this. And 3056, I think, gave a pathway. So we'd like to continue down that and be able to work things out in a positive way. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hannis. Mr. Novak.
Michael Novak with the League of Oregon Cities. I'll be brief. I don't think I could add anything better than what Mr. Jensen and Ms. Cartmill and Ann have added. You know, the League of Oregon Cities was a part of that negotiation group. It was quite a positive negotiation that led to 3056, in that it especially protected the ability of communities to still use urban renewal, and I was particularly struck by the recognition of folks like Alec with TVFNR the value that urban renewal really brings to communities as a whole. The negotiations, as stated again, really already struck a path for ensuring that there's a greater control by the overlapping taxing districts on urban renewal, as well as providing a mechanism to bring some of these, to returning some of the taxes to the overlapping taxing districts. And I certainly appreciate Representative Wan's interest in supporting urban renewal and certainly communities' involvement in the process. But as has been stated, House Bill 3155 is not needed at this time, as there's already a public process that is heavily involved with the community. And in fact, we feel that 3056 strengthened that process. And with that, I'd like to particularize my comments. Thank you.
That's a great finish, Mr. Mayor. Thank you very much. Are there any questions for the panel? Representative Lindsay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If you can let me ask a couple questions.
That's fine.
So you said that you wanted some time to grow up together and be nimble and learn how it works. It's been 2 years, right? Is that not enough? How much time do you need?
Well, I think we identified a period of 6 years. How a law unfolds doesn't happen every single step of the way, so you often don't know what's going to occur or how that's going to react. As Alec pointed out, I think in the first 2 years, a couple of good things did come out, vetted out the process. Some limits were established, but something may not have shaken out yet that could be a repercussion from changes that we made.
Okay. And I guess that's my next question is it seems like we're trying to identify things and shake some things out, and it looks like this is a perfect example of something that's shaken out, that you got a representative in his district that wants to have a public notice and a hearing. How this, that what was agreed upon 2 years ago, is not occurring, and he just wants to have that done. I've participated in lots of city hearings, and I'm just wondering how big of a hiccup this is going to cause in the system to simply add a public notice and a hearing.
Well, I could. We have some technical experts that we've brought along with us. I heard some conflicts in what the bill was calling an agency versus a plan versus a district, and I think there may be some confusion already in just that distinction and where the public process takes place within the establishment of each. Establishing an agency, it has no authority until the municipality gives it authority, and that's when the public process is initiated. So it's in itself, I believe, an example of without very careful coordination and review, possibly trying to institute a fix that doesn't necessarily accomplish what you were setting out to do. And again, I think it's a state statute that is a local tool, and if there is concern about when a public process is initiated, it could be addressed at the local level with the constraints in place in the statutes as they are now.
Do you have further follow-up?
Representative Lindsay, if I might just offer my own perspective on that. You know, your question was how long is long enough? It's been 2 years, it's actually been 18 months, but it's relatively minor point. It's a fragile coalition. You're looking at a group of people here that represent organizations that have always disagreed on elements of how urban renewal ought to be applied. On 3155, I'll suggest that there's elements of that we may disagree on today. What we're trying to accomplish, however, in this this collaborative spirit is to solidify the fragility of this relationship in a fashion where we can continue to do what we're doing today, which is to try to resolve these things, resolve our issues, resolve our disagreements in a less formal, less contentious environment. And 18 months or 2 years is not, in my view, is not an adequate period of time to have tested that.
Yeah, so what I understand is Representative Wan's major concern is that the citizenry does not, or he wants to confirm that they have a chance to bring forth their testimony and their concerns and be heard, and this is his tool to do that. If we do not have this tool, how do we satisfy his concern in the current system? How do the citizenry of that municipality get, how are they heard?
Does anybody else want to take that?
Well, just chairs, members of the committee, to that, I believe actually there's someone else signed up to testify who can walk through a little bit more of the process and the public involvement of urban renewal from start to finish.
Okay. Let's do that.
I'm not trying to punt. I'm just...
Someone who has the expert while she's leaving now. That's not good. Come on forward, please.
I'd like to.
I thought we were all, you know, waiting with bated breath for the explanation, and then you started to walk away. If you could start by identifying yourself.
I certainly will. My name is Jeanette Lawner. I am an attorney. I have been working in the field of urban renewal and redevelopment for more than a long time. And I... have been involved with the Association of Oregon Redevelopment Agencies for somewhat over 20 years, and first of all would like to confirm that 2009 was an extraordinary effort. I had spent every other legislative session here opposing changes in the urban renewal law because our group believed that everything was just fine. And so as we have moved forward and matured, we have realized that there needs to be this kind of collaborative effort that brings together not only all of the interested parties, but the citizenry. So with that, currently under the law, there's technically a two-step process. So the spot in the statute where this bill, House Bill 3155, fits is at the spot where it's called a municipality, but it's defined as either a city or a county. The law begins by saying a city or a county has an urban renewal agency living inside of it. That's the first line of the statute. And then it says, in order to activate that urban renewal agency, you have to pass a non-emergency ordinance. And the non-emergency ordinance does two things. It says that the powers of the urban renewal agency are going to be exercised by some particular body, and in a lot of cases it's a city council in or county commission in Oregon. And then it says that that same ordinance will declare that blighted areas exist in the city or the county, you know, in the jurisdiction. And so what you have at the spot where this bill would intervene is the activation of the agency. You have, and in a lot of cases, I mean, let's use PDC as an example, that happened in the 50s, okay? So you've activated an agency. You have not, however, identified a particular area, and this is, I think, a distinction that I want to make clear about, is when you're talking about establishing an urban renewal district, that's the area, the geographic area that you're going to address by using the tool of urban renewal with the plan, you know, these acreages that have been talked about. So when you establish an agency, you're just saying, we have within us the power to be an urban renewal agency. We want to be an urban renewal agency. And that's all that that ordinance is doing. So two things. First of all, the adoption of a non-emergency ordinance always requires under, as you all know, under municipal law to have public notice. I mean, you're going to have public notice of every non-emergency ordinance that comes before a jurisdiction. Whether or not a jurisdiction holds a public hearing on that non-emergency ordinance is within the power of the jurisdiction to determine. I think that's what Ms. Cartmill was getting at, was that that's a local decision that happens.
So may I interrupt there just quickly and ask, in that case, how often, in your experience, has it been the case that those jurisdictions have elected to do that? Is that a frequent occurrence?
Have elected to have one or not have one?
Correct. That's the which is which?
In my experience, they have one. And part of the reason is the other point that Ms. Cartmill made, which is the activation of an urban renewal agency often doesn't happen in a vacuum. It happens because there has been some area of the town or the county that looks like it needs some help. So there has been some discussion about, well, what do we want to do about a particular area? And so what we've got is, in the ordinance that is activating the agency, there's no geographic area. You know, it just talks about the city. That's why it says declaration. You know, it's like, you know, someone is... The other thing is, in my experience, there are staff reports. Again, this isn't required by the law. It's local. There are staff reports that say, here's how you can make that declaration. You know, we've got this problem or that problem in the city. But it's not tied to a particular plan or a particular plan area.
Representative Nathanson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The reason I want to interrupt is... having served on a city council for 12 years and also being a legislator, I can imagine that in some ways this very long explanation still seems like a whole lot of words, a whole lot of bureaucratic words. I'd like to paraphrase something a lot shorter and check to make sure that it's right.
I think that's an excellent idea. Please do.
Thank you. We're talking, what's being discussed right now doesn't actually answer the question yet that was asked, which is when does the public actually get to speak at a public hearing? Because they may or may not at this one point you're talking about. The first thing you do is you have enabling legislation that says, announces, we have a tool. You can't use the tool yet. It just says we have a tool. Then at the point you want to use the tool, you do have to have public hearings because you say, here's a place we want to use the tool. We want to do something. And then there's no chance that you're not going to have a public hearing because that has to go along with it. So there's really two different things. First, you enable yourselves to use a tool. And then at some point, if you want to use the tool, which is actually do some urban development, then you have to have public hearings and say, this is where we want to use the tool. That makes sense? Is that correct?
It is exactly correct. Thank you.
Well done. Thank you very much. Representative Lindsay, does that help your original question?
It does. Thank you, Mr. Chair. But that leads me to another question, and that is, you enable the tool, and then you go down the road to identify a geographic location to use that tool. And that's when you have that public hearing. My question is you've gone so far down the road with that tool in your hand, is it nearly impossible that public hearing, when you decide to use that tool in a geographic area, is it nearly impossible to turn back and to go the other way and not proceed?
Would it be reasonable, Representative Lindsay, to ask that same question in a slightly different way and by saying, does that happen frequently? Is that a sort of amendment to your question?
Mm-hmm.
I can restate it if that wasn't clear.
Representative Lindsay, co-chairs Benson, Reed. What I can tell you is that I'm aware of I track this pretty closely, and I'm aware of a few situations. The city of St. Helens got right to the point of getting the plan put together, right to the point of adoption. Public input resulted in them tabling that. Staten, I believe, actually adopted an urban renewal plan, not specifically to your point, but there was a remonstrance and the urban renewal plan was repealed. In our own case in Tualatin, with albeit a plan amendment, got to the point where there was public input and the city of Tualatin withdrew the plan. So that's all in the last 12 to 24 months. There's three that come readily to mind.
Any questions? Representative Sheehan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just trying to understand what could possibly be the objection with asking for public input before you guys go down that path. I just don't see why you can't hold a hearing. I mean, we work for the people. I don't get it.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, Vice Chair Sheehan. I don't think we have an objection to a public hearing. It's my understanding that as this process develops, there already are requirements for public hearings, and if there weren't requirements, the communities would make sure that those public hearings took place.
They're after the fact, though.
Follow-up?
I'm sorry, may I have a follow-up?
Yes.
This whole thing is just very bizarre to me that it seems like Representative Wan is asking something fairly innocuous, and then we find out there's this board of a bunch of regional government of these 13 people who have gotten together and said, let's have a peace treaty to get in the way of the people having a right to create laws.
Representative Sheehan, we've had we haven't had this admonishment yet on the House floor. But there's often a rule, there is a rule, not often, there's a rule that we try to avoid attributing motives to anyone else. So I take your point. I think it's reasonable to ask that, but let's ask them what they think rather than guessing at their motives.
All right.
Thanks. So maybe you could summarize what some more about your objection to the proposal here.
was.
I was kind of trying to verify what exactly was in the bill, because my recollection of what I read through the bill and what I testified to wasn't the idea of a public process, which certainly we've always gone through extensive public processes where they relate to urban renewal.
Do you have a copy of the bill? Would that be helpful?
No.
That's why I was looking to Jeanette. Specifically, I saw some conflict between the idea of an agency at startup versus a plan which has a very extensive public process involved with it, and then this idea of identifying blight early on when blight is what urban renewal addresses, and it is identified early on in the plan process. So I think it was more this idea of whether we're duplicating efforts as representative. I don't have my glasses on. Nathanson, I'm sorry. Pointed out, when you set up this tool that you may never use, I could look at any municipal authority, bonding authority, or you know, all the multitude of authorities they have. They're there at their disposal, and they don't. They then have the public process when they're going to implement that tool, and it just appears that the statutes are working well to facilitate that need.
Would it also be accurate to say that there's nothing that prevents the jurisdiction from electing of their own volition to have hearings at the stage where they're imagining the existence of the tool, to continue Representative Nathanson's
That's expression? Absolutely correct.
I could probably just clarify my question. I guess it would come down to, are you in opposition to elements of this bill, or are you in opposition to any bill that comes dealing with this topic because of your agreement?
Yeah, it sounds sort of incorrect when I say the latter. It really was the latter, because the hope, and maybe our outreach wasn't effective enough, was that we could start to work on these types of concerns locally. We are very concerned every time we try to address a concern. I believe Representative Ward said Portland doesn't do this, and I'm in East County, and so-and-so doesn't do that. Because Portland doesn't do it doesn't mean that it isn't working well as intended throughout many other jurisdictions in the state. And these are state statutes. So our goal is to identify these and work through them at the local level. So it's this overriding principle, I think, that's bringing us together. And again, it isn't just any one group of people that all like this or that or the other thing. There's a varying interests in this group of folks that got together, and it wasn't intended to omit anyone at all. So if there's issues out there, we'd love to do whatever we can to help them. We just don't support doing them through the state statutes without a lot of vetting, because of this ripple effect that can happen. And it may seem simple and innocuous, but it may or may not be.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was not going to ask any questions on this, but things,
because it's never too late.
I actually supported the last piece of legislation that we did last time through here, as every other member did on the floor. I see this, and I understand, I like the local control and everything. I understand why you guys like the setup right now. But after hearing some of the concerns and problems, I'm just wondering if this wouldn't help a little bit, because we're hearing about some of these projects that were taken down the rosy red path, and then they were taken back, like in Silverton, as you say. So I wonder if you could maybe step back, if we waited a few days, and look at this as maybe a positive thing with having that early on public hearing. Yes, it would be state mandated, but it would give people's input early on in the first phase of the game before we dump a ton of money, taxpayers' money, into trying to find a spot or to do our urban renewal and get the input at the front end rather than later at the back end and have to deal with the battle of trying them to buy off on it later on in the game. So kind of curious what your thoughts are on that. I'm very supportive of you guys having local control, but I see this as possibly being a very helpful tool for you.
Representative Widener, Co-Chair Reed, and Vince. what my message is not about 3155. I am going to try to speak to your question. And I would not want to characterize legislation as background noise. But what I'd like to try to convey here is that our ability, having reached a point now where you've got the AORA and the special districts and the League of Cities and the Oregon School Boards Association dialoguing and trying to resolve these problems, these issues, trying to address them at the local level, if you will, is contingent upon us not being adversaries. And so I think that my own perspective on the peace treaty, if you will, has been let's not put ourselves in a position, that's not whether this is a good bill or a bad bill, but let's not put ourselves in a position where we end up maintaining this kind of adversity at the legislative level by having to always find ourselves down here opposing one another. Let's take a step back of two or three sessions and let's try to do the good work that we believe we're capable of doing. And I hope that doesn't offend anybody. I'm just trying to convey really the spirit of the peace treaty. And so for me, it's not so much the merits of this bill, it's that let's just take a unified position as it relates to urban rural legislation. Let's stand together for a while so that we can maintain this fragile relationship and try to work through some of these issues.
And hopefully strengthen the fragile relationship.
Absolutely.
Too. Did you have a follow-up?
Yeah. You're hitting right where I want you to go. And one of the things to think about so we don't end up with seeing things like this here is having that public hearing up front. Because so many times as a citizens, forget about government and throw all the government agencies out. Sometimes as a citizen, you kind of feel steamrolled because it's like they already decided this and they have a plan in place. And I show up to the public hearing, this thing's already rolling down the road and I didn't get any say. That's the way your citizens and the people of the communities feel. That's where I can see the positive side of this. And I would rather not have to do anything legislatively, so even if it doesn't happen this time, it's something you should think about when you're putting this together and communicating with your communities is that upfront input. So, and that was a statement more than a question, but something for you to think about.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Widener. Representative Lindsay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My wife's going to have a great time tonight thinking that I had the time of my life with this one. This is the funnest I've had for a while, so...
I don't know if that. I don't know what to say. That.
Thanks yeah, she's gonna make fun of me big time tonight. So I think I've got this ironed out, and I'm just gonna summarize this, and you make sure I'm right. You enable your tool, go down the road, have a public hearing because you have then identified the geography. Have a public hearing. Yes, no. You go forward, or it stops. You are against having a public hearing when the tool is enabled because you don't know what the geography is yet. You don't know what the geographic thing is yet. Mr. Wan's argument is that he doesn't want to wait till we get down the road after that tool has been enabled because we've been so far down the road that it's hard to turn back if it needs to be turned back. Is that a good summary, number one? And then number two is don't we just solve this by having two public hearings? It seems like we're just going from one public hearing to two. One at the beginning when the tool is enabled, and then second when you have identified the geography, and that way both parties are satisfied. Am I right or wrong there?
Well, I can speak to the second part, which is what I understand is that Representative Wan's legislation essentially duplicates what's already taking place. And please correct me if I'm misstating that, which is one of the issues that was raised by Ms. Cartmill on that. And if I could veer if you'd indulge me, if I could veer quickly to. Refer to Representative Widener, thank you. And something that Jensen said about
about this collaboration, which is when Representative Wand informed the cities that he was going to be moving forward with this legislation, I sat down and I spoke with him, and we talked about the negotiation in 3056, and his ears perked up at the when I told him that there was a group that we were working together to try and make this work and make it as a useful tool, long-term useful tool for communities. He asked if he could be invited, and I certainly said, of course you could. So we're looking forward to continuing these dialogues amongst ourselves and with legislators.
Thanks. Any further questions? I don't see any. Thank you very much. We have a couple more people to hear from on this bill. Mark Landauer and David Barenberg, please.
Chair Reed, Chair Bentz, members of the committee, I'm David Barenberg from the City of Portland, and I appreciate the opportunity to appear before you this afternoon. I was going to cover two issues. First is to very briefly talk about the legislation from last session and the process, and then also go to the issue of what public hearings and process currently exists in the establishment of urban renewal plans. Can also address more specifically, if you want, some issues with the legislation, but first I'll go through the first two issues. The process last year, for members who weren't here in previous sessions, the parties who are here at the table together, that was really an amazing change from 2 years ago when we were arguing about what was the shape of the negotiating table that we would be around. And that the parties have got to know one another, and more importantly, got to know the different perspectives and issues that each was bringing to the table, and an understanding that each side had valid points that needed to be addressed. And that really was a fundamental change in the relationship. And it was one driven by the legislature, which said, you get in a room, we're tired of having you fighting, and you address this in some manner where we can move forward in an ongoing way, and we don't have to keep fighting this fight every session. That was what was achieved with the legislation last session. And the legislation last session was an earth shift in the way decisions were made in continuing or in extending the life of urban renewal areas. That was one of the major sticking points, was you promised that you're going to end an urban renewal area in 20 years, and oftentimes that wasn't the case. They'd be renewed in the special districts and counties and others who are losing revenue, or what they would consider losing revenue because of urban renewal, said, you had a promise that at the end of this, you were going to rise our boats. There was going to be an increase of value. You'd share the wealth, and that wasn't happening in all cases. What we did last session, or what you did last session, was adopt a law that said that has to change, and it did. That now, to extend the life of a district, you need the approval of the taxing districts representing 75% of the underlying value in that area. So you create a collaborative process moving forward. We also created, by agreement between the parties, this process of meeting together to try to address these issues. So you made a fundamental change in the way business was conducted, and also built a lasting relationship to try to keep as many of these issues out of the building as possible. And not only that, I'll move on. It's a Friday afternoon. Now to get to the issue of process. There is process that's required statutorily. There's also process that's adopted locally to meet local needs. And for the City of Portland and the Portland Development Commission, that we have 5 formal opportunities for public testimony prior to the approval of a plan. One of which requires what we would call super notice, which is notice to so many different parties that the mailing costs for the city alone are around $50,000, in addition to other, media and public notification vehicles that we utilize. What we do locally is we made an agreement with our county and school districts in 2007 so that when we have a commitment to consult and confer with them, to include membership on all of our committees, and to appear before them and for public hearings to allow for review and comment on our plan. So not only do we have our internal public hearings, we have public hearings before our partners who are bearing some of the tax impact of an urban renewed area. We also have public hearings and testimony before the PDC board. We have public hearings and testimony before our planning commission. We have public hearings and action before our city council. So we have public hearings and public hearings. To the point that was raised about does this have momentum, and once you have a plan in an area, does it go through? No. Our central city plan, as many of you might have read, went down substantially due to criticisms and concerns raised by our other partners and the citizenry. So when you propose something, you are proposing an idea that is subject to significant change or to being dropped because of the process that that we have. Regarding blight. Blight is defined statutorily with a very long definition, which includes some things that folks might not consider as blight. You know, it addresses sort of highest use of an areas and properties, and not that every individual property has to be collapsing, be condemnable, but, you know, broader development issues are also considered in some of the definitions of blight. So we do have process. We do abide by the definitions of blight, and we're very pleased with the relationship that we have developed with our partners and in the past our opponents on these issues. And with that, I'm happy to stop talking and answer any questions that the committee may have.
Let's hear from Mr. Landauer first, and then we'll take questions.
Good afternoon, Chair Reed, members of the committee. Mark Landauer representing the Special Districts Association of Oregon. Our association represents approximately 900 special districts across the state of Oregon, providing array of services to the citizens. SDAO is opposed to House Bill 3155 for many of the reasons that were previously articulated, and to Representative Lindsay's question, having in the previous life represented a city, I know for a fact that when an ordinance is to be heard, it's to the locally elected officials' peril that they do not hold a hearing. So I would just note that we do oppose this bill in the spirit of trying to keep this collaborative group together. This has been a bitterly fought issue for a very long time, and I hope that this continued working relationship will be beneficial to all of us. I think that it has borne a great deal of fruit up to this point, and I hope that we can allow the bill that was passed back in 2009 to have some more impacts on engaging the public on these very, very difficult issues. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you both. And Mr. Berenberg, you were very respectful when you said you as opposed to we, but I think you were a little too deferential, you and the others who have been here today and others who have not played a significant role in getting us to where we are. So I think we was actually appropriate. Are there questions? I don't see any. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That completes the list of people who have signed up to testify on House Bill 3155. Is there anyone else who would like to be heard on this bill? Don't see any, so we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3155. I've misplaced my agenda, but I believe our next one is 3150, right? Yeah, so open the public hearing on House Bill 3150. Representative Cannon, thank you for your patience. If you want to join us, and Zach can give us a summary as we get started. It's worth noting as we do that we're talking today about the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 3155. So Zach could give us a summary based on that, hopefully.
Yeah, House Bill 3150, as amended, allows the road authority to establish an ordinance, or by ordinance, that the speed limit on a greenway it can go 5 miles per hour lower than the statutory speed.
Representative Cannon, and it looks like you're wanted to invite some people up with you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will invite a couple of others up to the dais with me, if I may.
Please do.
For the record, State Representative Ben Cannon, very glad to be bringing this important piece of urban renewal district legislation to you. That was a joke. Thank you.
I got it. Yeah.
All right, very good. In fact, I hope this is a somewhat simpler conversation. This bill relates to neighborhood greenways, and I want to, before I say a few words about the gist of the bill, talk just very briefly about what a neighborhood greenway is, since the term may not be familiar to all members of the committee or the public. Neighborhood greenways have been established in my city, the city of Portland, as alternative routes for cyclists and pedestrians. They're residential streets that have been specially marked to encourage cyclists to use them instead of the main arterials. And I, as a cyclist, as the parent of a budding cyclist, appreciate the work that the city has done to establish these low-traffic, low-conflict routes for cyclists and pedestrians. They help reduce conflict between cyclists and pedestrians and drivers. They help improve safety for all road users. And they help lower the cost of building bike infrastructure with substantial co-benefits. So that's a neighborhood greenway. They parallel arterials. They're through neighborhood streets. They're low traffic. They're well signed. They're really great places for cyclists and pedestrians to get around. This bill, pretty simply, is a permissive bill that would allow local governments to establish neighborhood greenways with a 20-mile-per-hour speed limit on certain neighborhood streets. The characteristics of those streets are described in the Dash 1 amendments. They would have to meet certain tests. But the crux of this bill is that it would allow local governments, give them a tool they don't currently have under law, to reduce the speed from the standard 25 miles per hour of a residential street down to 20 miles per hour. And I think this just helps reinforce and improve the experience for those using a neighborhood greenway, makes it even more likely that this system designed to reduce conflict and improve experience of our roads for all users will be a success. So I'm going to turn it over to the folks here from the City of Portland who can tell you a little bit more about what we're trying to do.
Thank you. Please go ahead.
Chair Reed, Chair Benz, committee members, thank you for the opportunity to present before you today. In the interest of time, my name is Tom Miller. I'm the incoming director of transportation for the Portland Bureau of Transportation. Again, I thank you for the opportunity to be here. And thank you, Representative Cannon, for the excellent summary of what is before you. In the interest of time, I'll cut right to the chase in terms of my testimony that can complement what we just heard from Representative Cannon. First of all, why 30 miles an hour down to 20 miles an hour, or 25 miles an hour down to 20 miles an hour? There is something magic about 20 miles an hour, as it were. And our traffic engineer is here, Rob Birchfield. We'll hear from him momentarily on the science behind this. But in short, the Federal Highways Administration tells us through study that a pedestrian who conflicts with a motor vehicle traveling 30 miles an hour has a 40% chance of being killed. Conversely, that same pedestrian who would have an altercation with a motor vehicle traveling 20 miles an hour has just a 5% chance of being killed. So we can substantially reduce the likelihood of fatalities on our streets by having this important piece of legislation in place wherein municipalities across the state can reduce motor vehicle speeds on these streets with certain criteria from speeds greater than 20 miles an hour down to 20 miles an hour. Again, it's permissive, as the representative said. No municipality in the state would be required to do this. It's simply an opt-in system. It's also worth noting that it would cost state taxpayers no money whatsoever. So we have an opportunity today to potentially save lives on our streets at no cost whatsoever to state government or state taxpayers. This is not something that would happen instantaneously across the city of Portland or perhaps any city in the state of Oregon. There is very specific and strict criteria wherein we would, where municipalities like Portland would consider reducing speed limits down to 20 miles an hour. First, a street must have 2,000 trips per day or fewer. Secondly, of those 2,000 trips...
And of the 2,000 trips, is 2,000 trips total or...
Motor vehicle trips. Okay. Thank you for the clarification.
Thank you.
2,000 motor vehicle trips or fewer per day. And of those 2,000 trips, 85% of those 2,000 trips or fewer must already be traveling at 30 miles an hour or less. If those two substantive criteria are met, then a city council would be required to reduce speed by ordinance. So it's not something we would do in a frivolous manner. It's something that is, the process is very methodical, it's been thought out, and again, there is strong science behind it. So with that, I'll wrap up. Of course, I would be happy to take any questions you have, but I appreciate your consideration of this important opportunity to save lives on the streets of Oregon cities and communities.
Thank you for being here. Mr. Richfield.
Chair Benz, Chair Reed, members of the committee, my name is Rob Birchfield. I'm the city traffic engineer for the City of Portland. And I'd like to just highlight a few more of the specifics of the bill, talk a little bit about the limitations that Tom highlighted, and a couple of the benefits. First, as Tom noted, this House Bill 3150 is limited to roads that meet the statutory definition of a residence district and have a 25-mile-an-hour speed designation, therefore by a statute. Higher-order streets such as arterials and collectors that serve as primary routes for motor vehicles would not be eligible for this speed reduction. As Tom noted, that it would apply only to streets with traffic volumes of 2,000 vehicles per day or less. Most of our collector and arterial streets, in at least the municipalities in Oregon, carry more typically between 5,000 and 25,000 vehicles per day. It would also be limited to streets that already have relatively low speeds. As Tom said, the 85th percentile speed must be less than 30 miles per hour. And in explanation, an 85th percentile speed is commonly used as a sort of an engineering benchmark for how we define and talk about the speed of characteristics of a roadway, so it's a commonly used terminology and measure. The regulation is also limited to streets that include some type of traffic control devices that indicate the presence of pedestrian and bicycles, so you'll see signs and markings that indicate that these are streets that have bike routes on them, safe routes to school, school crossings, pedestrian crossings, those types of activities. The bill requires that the road authority post a sign giving notice of the designated speed at each at the beginning of each street segment and other places necessary to inform the public. So the way we would implement that in Portland is we'd have a 20-mile-per-hour speed at the beginning of the segment, and then each time we have a cross street, any type of major cross street that crosses it, then we would post it again with 20 miles an hour so the public would clearly know that they are on a 20-mile-per-hour street. And finally, the regulation limits it to jurisdictions where the road authority has established by ordinance a designated speed for the neighborhood greenway. So we would have to, again, the practice would be in the City of Portland, we would have a hearing and adopt an ordinance that applies to the specific street or group of streets that we're going to apply this to. A clear benefit to us is that we can reduce the likelihood of injuries and potentially fatalities. As Tom said, speed goes up pretty dramatic. As the risk of injury goes up dramatically as speed goes up. And the final thing I would say, this is just one tool, but it's a cost-effective tool for us that helps make this type of program effective. We've learned from the research that we've done on our streets, looking at where injuries occur, that our busiest streets are really where we have the most types of traffic injuries, and that's not just for folks in motor vehicles, but also for pedestrians and cyclists. So creating alternatives to those streets that are attractive for users is the strategy that we're pursuing. This will help us be effective in that. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. I imagine we probably do have some questions. Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The 2,000 per day, as called out in the bill, says has an average volume of fewer than 2,000 motor vehicles per day. It doesn't say trips. Is it trip round trip or one time down the street?
The way we would count that is simply it's any vehicle that crosses a point is a vehicle counted on that roadway one time? So anytime a vehicle crosses, basically we put pneumatic tubes across the roadway. I'm sure you've seen them. And anytime they cross that, they're counted. And so when you get to that's how we would get to the count of how many vehicles per day are crossing that line in the street.
Out of curiosity, do you have a percentage breakdown of the number of streets that fit the designation in Portland?
I don't, but it's actually a pretty good sized number, because most of our residential streets, which is probably more than 80% of our road miles, would meet the definition of a residence district, would have that feature of being less than 2,000 cars per day. Now, they might not meet the other criteria as well.
The concept is that the automobile needs to give way to some other type of use, thus the slower speed for the automobile. And that would mean that there should be some measure of the other type of use, whether it's pedestrian or cyclist. So when you're looking at what you're going to do, you only have two measures here. One is the speed by which they're traveling. The other is the number of more vehicles. What is it that is how do you get to the point of this actually being used? Is that the ordinance exercise where folks would come in and say, we want the designation, and they then would have to prove some of this other alternative use, volume of something other than cars?
Well, you have kind of posed an interesting dilemma that we are challenged with, and that is the sort of chicken and egg process of how do you create a street environment that pedestrians and bicyclists feel comfortable using. To do that, what they tell us is basically they want fewer cars and lower speeds. And we're trying to, through design and management, create those street environments and target those strategies to specific streets. So where we have done traffic calming measures that already physically reduce the speed, that might be through speed bumps, other types of traffic calming measures, and where we have actually provided route information that may guide people as to a good route to get to a neighborhood business area or a good route to get to the neighborhood school, we'll be directing people to use these streets. Then we also want to pair that with the measures that make it comfortable for them. So sometimes we've got to do those actions first before we get the numbers. And it's a logical way to proceed is first to do the things that make the environment comfortable for folks and then encourage them to use it.
Follow up.
Please.
The cost of signage for these streets, have you run those numbers to see what it would cost? I'm just curious about other limiting factors. If you have to put the signs up, that's going to be a limiting factor. I'm just curious what they're going to cost.
Well, for us, for our crews to install a speed sign, it's probably about $75 a sign with labor when they're doing it, in an efficient manner.
Which we hope is always.
Well, let's just say they're going down the street, they're doing a number of them, as opposed to running around doing one here and then running across to do another one somewhere else. But if they're doing them sort of in bulk, that's probably a reasonable cost estimate. There would be what I would term a relatively minor cost, an operational cost to put in the speed signs. That for us would be the only real cost. The other things we're doing already in terms of the other types of signing and markings, those are already there.
If I may, Chair Benson, just a potential point of clarification. Mr. Birchfield suggested that perhaps the majority of Portland's roads, in the case of Portland, perhaps most of our roads would qualify. I want to be clear for the committee that that's not to say that all roads would be treated in this manner. In fact, just a few roads would be treated in this neighborhood greenway manner. That's, again, a special designation, and it's one that we choose in a very particular and strategic way. So this is not something that would be spread across the city of Portland or any city for that matter, I suspect.
And maybe you could say something about how that process goes along after you've identified, to your point, maybe a lot would be eligible, but you wouldn't pursue it for all of them.
That's exactly right, Chair Reed. And perhaps, Rob, can you clarify how we go about choosing a neighborhood greenway?
Well, for us, we're largely doing this by plan. I mean, we have a transportation system plan, and in there we have designated routes that are priorities for pedestrians and for bicycles. And we also have a Safe Routes to School program, and as a part of that program, we are designating, or at least identifying the best routes for particular schools to use. And there's a convergence among all those, and I think that's really recognizing that convergence is where this Greenway concept has really come to the fore, and that is that most of them use the same or similar street segments. So that's what we're doing. We're trying to execute our plan as to where these streets are that we want to provide for priority for those type of uses.
Representative Wyden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The thing that has me concerned a little bit is the safety factor. We're saying it's going to be safe for it going down, but with me not living in Portland, if I drive up there and get on one of these greenways, and this not being part of a learning process when we're taking our driver's ed or anything like that, which I hopefully will never have to take driver's ed again, I might be going too fast. I may not realize that this is a bike-only deal, and that's where the conflicts come into, is a guy making a right-hand turn and the bicyclist wanting to go right on through the green light. He gets hit by the car that's making that turn or the truck that's making that turn. And I'm wondering if we're not making the situation worse by taking one of these zones, and then you get some stranger up in Portland who doesn't belong there, like myself, driving these streets. And
you're always welcome in Portland, I promised you that.
So I actually end up there quite a bit, but I'm just worried about creating a scenario where we have a different set of standards in Portland than we do across the rest of the state.
Co-Chair Reed, Representative Widener, I think you raised some important questions. I want to give a really concrete illustration of what this means in my district, and I think it's actually, I'll refer to a street with which I think you are familiar, which is 82nd Avenue. And it's a 5-6 lane, I mean, there are turn lanes, busy highway, essentially, huge arterial.
State highway.
And it contains three of the ten most dangerous intersections in the city of Portland, I assume probably among the very most dangerous intersections in the state of Oregon. Numerous pedestrian, cyclists, and automobile-related injuries per year, some deaths. And what the city is proposing to do is build, and in the process of doing, is establish a neighborhood greenway, not on 82nd Avenue, but on 85th, 86th, 87th Avenue. It will be signed accordingly. And I don't know if we have can project signs, but we can distribute to the committee how that looks for drivers and for cyclists to divert those cyclists who are currently trying to use 82nd Avenue along with tens, hundreds of thousands of automobiles. We're trying to divert them over to 85th, 86th, reduce the speed on those neighborhood streets. And these are little neighborhood streets. They're not ones that a driver would use to get very far. And thereby reduce the conflict that's occurring on 82nd Avenue. The safety benefits, I think, are quite significant. And I haven't taken perhaps your question on quite directly, but I wanted to give you an illustration of what this would mean in practice in my part of the world.
Well, yeah, I would say in that example, probably the only reason you would, and if you look at this graphic that's on page 4 of a handout that I hope that you have, it shows that parallel route concept and with the real case of 82nd Avenue there. If you were visiting your relative who lived over there on 85th, you might get to that street. That would be the only reason you'd get there unless you were otherwise lost. I mean, these are very low-volume neighborhood streets that don't carry any through traffic. And I think the other parts of this that are standard traffic control things that any driver is supposed to be aware of is speed signs, warnings about pedestrians crossing, et cetera. So it shouldn't take anybody by surprise if you're, say, from out of the area, because we've been using the standard things we always use to tell people about what the environment they're in, they're driving in, what cautions they should take, what speed they should be driving.
Did you have a follow-up, Richard?
Yes. Now, what you're doing, I commend you guys for, because this is really good, but I'm thinking in the back of my mind, is it really the right solution? I mean, sometimes I wonder if we shouldn't be finding another funding mechanism with bicyclists through licensing or something like that and actually making actual bike ways. One of the things we're looking at a project out in our district is doing some things like that. Because I see cars still parked over here and we're riding alongside of them where, to me, when I see this, I'm thinking maybe we shouldn't even have parking there and keep that side open to bicyclists only and look at addressing the issues more in that manner rather than a Band-Aid approach.
Co-Chair Reed, Representative Weiner, I personally, I think you're right. We need a multiplicity of approaches. And that's what the city has employed. We have dedicated bike lanes. We have other bicycling infrastructure. These have turned out to be, in my view, a lower cost and better outcome approach to helping reduce conflict between cyclists, pedestrians, and drivers, as opposed to having to build, you know, specific bike infrastructure that would take space away from vehicles on roads. I mean, one of the challenges of building bike lanes, which is what I sort of grew up expecting to find in Portland, was my dedicated bike lane. Well, that's great when those exist, except you're often in a busy street. There are dangers associated, even if it's a marked bike lane. And can't put them on every street without taking room away from automobiles. So this is an effort to, you know, help shift some of our bicycling infrastructure to the neighborhood streets where the impact will be less.
And this is not simply about bicycles either. It should be noted that this is for neighborhood safety, for pedestrians of all ages, of all needs. We have found through the advent of our neighborhood greenway program that pedestrians find these corridors, these parallel corridors, parallel to the busy arterials that Representative Cannon referenced in the example of 82nd. These are more attractive corridors for both bicyclists and pedestrians.
Other questions? Representative Sheehan, sorry, you indicated earlier, I forgot, sorry.
No problem. And I promise not to ask anything about motivations.
That's fine.
I just wanted to get some clarification on Neighborhood Greenway. Is that something that's part of the City of Portland's vernacular? Is that like in a statute or ordinance or something? Or where does, because I know you define it further down here saying, as used in the subsection, Neighborhood Greenway is defined as this. Can you just speak to that really quickly?
You bet. Rob, do you want to take that?
I'll try. I think this is the only definition, attempt to define what a neighborhood greenway. Other than that, it's been a term of art for us.
Okay, yeah, because I Googled, I'm sorry, follow up?
Please.
I Googled the thing, and it's full of City of Portland stuff. I guess my concern would be, is this creating the concept of a neighborhood greenway that could be used elsewhere, and Representative Cannon and I were talking about the like blockages in the streets that are designed to encourage bicycle traffic versus vehicle traffic. This doesn't do that, does it? This doesn't actually...
It does not.
Okay.
That's right. And again, importantly, this piece of legislation before you is opt-in for you municipalities. No community in the state of Oregon would be obligated under any circumstance to deploy any of this.
Thank you.
Have you had any indication that other cities are pursuing similar approaches?
I may not be the best person to respond to that, but I know that other cities are interested in the ability to have 20-mile-per-hour speeds in residence areas, you know, that have active use and around schools, that in areas that go beyond the legal definition of where you can put a school zone.
Okay. Any other questions, Representative Sheehan?
Just one quick one. How many fatalities did we have in Oregon this year that were a car and a bicycle, or do we have that data?
I don't have my fingertips.
We might be having some other folks following who might have a sense of that.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's okay. I'm not guaranteeing that they do, but there might be some other people who are in a better position to have that.
Are they scrambling now?
Let's hope.
We can certainly, if we're not able to retrieve an answer momentarily, obviously we can for you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks very much. A few more people who would like to testify. Rhonda, and I'm a little worried about pronouncing your last name. One more time, please.
Zaycox,
thank you very much. Jonathan Manton and Steph Rouse. Great. Rhonda, you're here first. Go ahead.
Okay, great. Well, good afternoon, Chairs Benson, Reed, and other members of the committees. My name is Rhonda Zaycox, and
I really thank you for the opportunity to share why I, as a Southwest Portland resident and mother of two Portland elementary school children, strongly support HB 3150, the amendment. Just for the record, I serve as the Maplewood Elementary PTA Safe Routes to School Committee and serve on the board of the Maplewood Neighborhood Association. For those of you who aren't familiar with Southwest Portland is an area well known for its hilly terrain, blind curved roads, and lack of safe places for walking and biking. Our family, like many families living in Southwest Portland Maplewood neighborhood, enjoy walking or biking with our children to our local school, our local Portland parks, our City of Portland Parks and Recreation Southwest Community Center, and our local business center, Multnomah Village. All of these amenities are located within a mile radius of the Maplewood neighborhood. The primary challenge we face to access these places on foot or bike is traffic safety concerns. As well documented in several city formal reports and nonprofit organizations, our Maplewood neighborhood lacks the basic active transport infrastructure for safely walking or biking, such as sidewalks, extended shoulders, or bike lanes.
Ms. Acox, I'm noticing that you're reading your testimony, which is before us, in the interest of time. And a few people come after you. I wonder if you could just sort of summarize for us and let us know the bulk of your concerns.
Sure.
Thanks.
No problem. The main issue that I guess I would like to highlight really is the support for the neighborhood greenway idea that the City of Portland is promoting. Maplewood would be a great beneficiary of such a proposal. And the reason why we believe, many of us in Maplewood, that reducing the speed limit from 25 to 20 in some of our areas would help in conjunction with the neighborhood greenways to slow down the traffic. I really do want to point one example that I think would illustrate this. In our neighborhood, we have a road called Maplewood Road, surprisingly, I know, that really is the direct route to our local elementary school and to our business district, Multnomah Village. And that road has absolutely no shoulders, no place to walk but in the middle of the road. And our children, our school has walking school buses. Every Thursday, parents lead four different routes around our neighborhood to get to our school. Two of our walking school bus routes have to walk on Maplewood Road. And so we believe that reducing the speed along with some of the other amenities that we're talking about would enable our children and our families to walk safely to school and to other places in Maplewood. So I think that captures my main point. Thank you for listening.
Thanks very much. Let's hear from the rest of the panel, and then we might have questions for you.
Members of the committee, Co-Chairs Reed and Co-Chairs Bentz. My name is Jonathan Manton, and I'm here today representing the Bicycle Transportation Alliance. We're an organization that has grown to about 5,000 members that was started in 1990 to promote cycling and to improve cycling conditions for all roadway users. And one of the big kind of, I guess, goals that we're kind of always thinking about is how do we reduce conflict and promote safety for all of the users of the roadway. We support this legislation and for all basically the reasons that have already been stated today. So I won't go into too much detail, but we do think this legislation provides an opportunity to create substantial safety benefits on some of our busiest streets, but also the low-traffic parallel routes, which are so key, with very little investment required. So I just want to thank you for having these hearings and for pushing this legislation, and I'm happy to answer any questions if I can. And also, I'll just add, Rep. Sheehan, I'll get you the information that you asked for earlier with regard to traffic fatalities involving bicycle conflicts. I don't have it in front of me, but I'll get it for you.
Great. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Co-Chairs Benson Reed and members of the committee. My name is Stephanie Routh. I'm director of the Willamette Pedestrian Coalition. We are a nonprofit organization dedicated to making the conditions for walking safe, convenient, and attractive for everyone. I will try to give you the gift of brevity, but we deeply support House Bill 3150 for safety reasons and livability. Over the past 2 years, the WPC has conducted a study called Getting Around on Foot Action Plan, which looks to identify priorities for improvements in walking environments. One of the things that we did, including talking to neighborhood associations, we had actually a really great conversation with Maplewood, was about 900 resident surveys online asking them what their top concerns were, and the top concerns were conflicts with vehicles and vehicular speeds. And one of their the major themes of a need was safe crossings, particularly across arterials like 82nd Avenue, 122nd, Barber, such as Representative Cannon's mentioned, and neighborhood greenways would provide these safe crossings. So lower speeds save lives. Tom Miller already spoke about that. But one thing I think just as important as moving more slowly in terms of traffic safety is being able to stop more quickly. And the second and third pages of the testimony I hope you have in front of you is just today a child road risk study talking about children perception and roadway use. And so just a quick that while adult pedestrians can make accurate judgments for vehicles traveling up to 50 miles per hour, children of primary school age become unreliable once the approach speed goes above 20 miles per hour if the car is 5 seconds away. So basically, I believe that House Bill 3150 would create an environment so that children can be able to more accurately judge for themselves when it's safe to cross the street or move into the roadway. So I'm happy to answer any questions that you may have, but thank you very much for this opportunity.
Thanks very much, Ms. Roth. Questions? Representative Lindsay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just wondering, is there nothing in place already at the local level to do this? I would think that there's something that we don't have to come all the way to Salem to the Capitol and get state legislation passed to do this for something so local. I'm sure the answer is yes, because you're here. I guess it's
Representative Lindsay and co-chairs, members of the committee, that's the case. Right now, roadway, it's the term of art, I think, is road authority. So right now, the road authorities, which in the case of a city or county on a county road or city on a city road, need this legislation in order to reduce the speed limit from, say, 25 to 20. That is the case.
Thanks for teaching a member of the Transportation Economic Development Committee.
Or more than one, too, probably, yeah. In the case of me. Representative Wyden?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is actually for you, or co-chairs. I would almost like to hear from Troy from ODOT and get a little feedback from him. I don't see him sitting out here, but...
Representative Wyden, we can do part of that in the case of ODOT, not necessarily Troy, because you're right, he's not here, but I think we are going to hear from ODOT next. Thank you very much. Appreciate your presence and your testimony. There's one other person who has signed up, Craig Honeyman, and though ODOT did not sign up, we've had a couple of requests for you to join us, so if you could come forward and help us understand some things, too, that'd be great.
Representative Reed, members of the committee, my name is Craig Honeyman. I represent the League of Oregon Cities. I'm here very briefly to tell you that the League supports the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 3150. As the percentage of non-automobile users, bicyclists, and pedestrians in urban areas increases, it makes sense to provide cities with the tools like this bill would provide to control speeds under certain circumstances. Again, this bill is permissive. It's not a mandate. To the extent that cars are somehow incentivized by this bill not to be in these greenways, or more importantly, bicyclists are incentivized to be in the greenways and away from those conflict points that you've heard about. That's a good thing. And also, as you've heard, as speeds come down, so does the extent of, God forbid, accidents when they do occur. So for all those reasons, the League of Oregon Cities wishes to register support for these amendments. Thank you.
Thanks very much. Let's ask you if there are any questions for Mr. Honeyman. If not, we can excuse him and proceed with the discussion with ODOT. Any questions for Mr. Honeyman? I don't see any. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair Reed, Chair Benz. My name is Tim Potter. I'm the legislative coordinator for ODOT through the Highway Division. If I understand there sounds like a number of questions. I hope I can respond to all of them.
Thanks very much. We'll get underway with Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The concept of the state retaining jurisdiction over these roads is to have uniformity such as that which was referred to by Representative Widener earlier. So the allowance of any city with that meets these standards and the 2,000 vehicle per day, I don't think any of my cities exceed that. And so all of those across my district would immediately be able to adopt this standard. My question is this. Aside from just not having that uniformity that one might hope or think was the original reason for the jurisdictional retention by the state, what happens when we slow down traffic on these roads? Doesn't it then mean that that traffic moves to other more speedy arterials? Isn't that what actually happens as opposed to people slowing down? What really happens?
Chair Benz, listening to the prior testimony, that's what they intend. I my sense is that that's what would occur, yes, sir.
Actually, follow up.
Please.
Actually, I thought they were trying to move the bicyclists and the pedestrians over to these streets, not the speedy cars off them. Or was it both?
Oh, maybe I misunderstood.
Representative Benz, one thing, we'd still have Representative Cannon here, the author, if you'd like to ask him directly about the intent. That's always a good
Well, of course I do.
He was ready.
Of course I do. But I do want to ask him. But my first question first, I guess, and that is, does the state have an interest in maintaining this uniformity of the 25-mile-an-hour speed limit in residential neighborhoods? And is the benefit that's going to be achieved by virtue of this device greater than retaining that uniformity?
Well, I believe there's distinct advantage to the uniformity. This particular instance requiring the 85th percentile to be below that the speed would actually fall within the guidelines that we would use to evaluate that criteria anyway. So essentially this would get to the same result that the rather convoluted process we do today. For that uniformity, where a local jurisdiction would have to come to us and request that speed reduction, and we'd go through the process to determine if they did indeed meet this criteria.
And I think my follow up,
yes, please.
My thought about the shift of traffic from one road to another, is that a local concern more than the state's? Is that up to the city to sit there and say, yes, we're going to dedicate these streets to pedestrians and cyclists? We know there's going to be more traffic on the other arterials, but that's the way it goes. That's up to the city to decide those kind of issues.
Chair Benz, again, this really, from our perspective, affects none of the roads that we're the road authority on. So I guess that would essentially be the case. Yes, sir.
Thank you. I do have a question or two for the
Let's ask Representative Cannon up. And while he's coming, I also got a note that Tom Miller does have the statistics, and he'd like to come up and share that as well. So that perhaps could also be useful. Representative Cannon. And Representative Benz, I guess, is the question.
Thank you.
Sorry.
Can you, Representative, I wanted to ask, I forgot to ask during your earlier testimony about the less than 30 miles per hour. The 30 miles per hour is obviously greater than the 25, I think, but I'm not sure exactly. This was targeted. It said the paragraph 10A is 5 miles per hour lower than the statutory speed. Then we drop down, and it's 30 miles is called out. So the target apparently is a 25 mile an hour zone, but I'm not sure. So just curious, was this bill designed for a 25 mile an hour zone, not other speeds? And is it supposed to be limited to just that 25? And if it is, so there's really two questions there. One, is it just a 25-mile-an-hour zone we're targeting? And two, why the 30 miles per hour?
So thank you, Co-Chairs Reed and Benz. My understanding is that this bill targets residential streets where the statutory speed limit is 25 miles an hour, and it would only be permissible for a local government, a city or county, to change that 25 to 20 if the if traffic on that street is 2,000 trips or fewer per day, and the average actual speed, putting aside the speed limit, but the average actual speed of those trips is 30 miles an hour or less.
Follow up. Just this line 20 suggests we have a city filled with scofflaws that all exceed the 25 miles.
That is correct. Are you calling my constituents scofflaws?
Yes.
They are.
We'll continue that conversation after this.
Okay.
Thank you very much. Mr. Miller, you have some info to share.
Yes, thank you. Representative Sheehan, we've got the facts for you.
All right.
15 bicycle motor vehicle-related fatalities last year in the state of Oregon. Just a point of clarification, our friend and colleague Bob Russell from the Oregon Trucking Association had to depart, but his organization supports this effort. And finally, just a point of clarification perhaps for you, Co-Chair Benz, and anybody else on the committee. The City of Portland's plans for deployment, should we be successful in achieving this legislation, would result in a change to about less than 1% of total lane miles across the city. So I appreciate the chance, Co-Chair Benz, to clarify that piece. So the deployment is quite modest in scope.
Thank you.
Very good. Any other questions? Thank you all very much. That completes the list of people who have signed up to testify on this bill. Is there anyone else who'd like to be heard on House Bill 3150? I don't see any. So we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3150 and open a work session on House Bill 3150. Representative Benz?
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the -1 amendments to House Bill 3150 dated February 18th, 2011.
Thank you. Representative Benz moves the adoption of the -1 amendments to House Bill 3150, dated February 18th, 2011. Is there any discussion? I don't see any. Is there any? Representative Lindsay?
I'm always discussing things in my head.
Okay.
So.
If you'd like us to join you, we'd be happy to.
Chair, I think there's plenty of voices in his head without us being there, too.
Thank you, Representative Widener. Is there any objection to the motion to adopt the -1 amendments? I don't see any. The motion carries, and the -1 amendments are adopted. Zach, we do have the fiscal and revenue. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
Both indicate zero, or no expenditure impact, no revenue impact. So this bill is ready to go if the committee is interested in doing that.
I'd be interested in having a day or two, if that's possible.
Okay.
For me, just personally.
Okay.
I would support Representative Lindsay on that.
Okay. We will we'll stop there then.
Fun. We were going to move a bill. I was excited.
We've done that before.
Happy down. I'm in favor of moving the bill.
We've done that before.
We were going to until you showed up, Representative Smith.
I ruined it. I heard you might have a vote, so I figured I'd come.
Good levity at the end of Friday, and with that, we'll close. Yes, we'll close the work session on House Bill 3150 with the caveat that we'll be carrying the bill over to our hearing on Monday. Should give Representative Lindsay, Representative Widener the weekend to think about things, and we'll hopefully be able to take it up again then. So the work session is closed, and Representative Benz, you're that much closer to home.
I am.
If there's anything else to come before the
committee, are you going home this weekend?
We'll adjourn the committee.
Right on.
Thanks.